Hey everyone, welcome back to the Daily Gold Podcast. Today we're speaking with Mickey Fulp. He's a professional geologist with decades of experience. You can see him interviewed on sometimes on CNBC, Fox Business News, among many other places. You can find him at goldgeologist.com. Mickey, how are you today?
I'm well, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well also. You know, Mickey, the first thing I want to talk about, we were talking beforehand, and you know, I'm reading some of your musings here, and I guess I have a two-part question to begin with. First of all, you were buying more physical gold into the extreme weakness that we've seen in the last several weeks. I want to ask you why you did that. And secondly, you're talking about how gold is becoming an increasingly bipolar market. Can you tell the listeners what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, the first thing is I always go buy gold on dips. So I've been sitting around since July 1st of 2011, waiting for gold to get below $1,500 again. And so when it did, I came in. Admittedly, I bought a little bit too early. I didn't get in at the bottom. But on the other hand, luckily, I bought from a placer miner in Alaska, and he cut me a really good deal, essentially with no premium. So I'm very happy with my gold purchase. It's just something I do. I'm a gold hoarder, and I think it needs to be held as a safe haven and an insurance policy. Concerning the second part of your question, we've had this divergence in gold, and it's very much been brought to light here with the market correction. And this was simply a market correction. Even if you take the high of gold of New York high of 1885 and September 5th of 2011 down to the bottom here, which gold closed in New York about 1350, that's still less than a 30% drop. And that, in terms of commodities, we define a correction as from 10 to 30%. Now, since then, gold has bounced quite well. It was down in the last 30 days. It dropped 16%. It is now recovered 6% of that. So what I've seen is a divergence between the physical and the paper market. And I refer to it as a bipolar metal. And I would say it has bipolar disorder. You have this manic side, which is the speculative paper market. It's very volatile, as futures and options, subject very much to panic and greed and algorithmic trading. So that's what happened during the so-called crash about 2 weeks ago. And then on the other side, you have the physical demand. And that is people, that comes from people that think that gold should be hoarded, and as I've said before, an insurance policy and a hedge against financial collapse. So that market tends to be stable. The gold is bought, it is not sold. And like me, most people that do this, they buy gold when it's a good value, i.e., when the price is down. So from that point of view, we see this very speculative market that I've heard figures, and I have no way to know if they're true, that it's 100 times larger than the physical market. But that's what leads to the volatility we've seen, and we saw that volatility today. Overnight, gold hit in the upper 1480s. It opened at in New York, I think, at about 1467, and it immediately went back up into the 1480s, and then about an hour and a half ago, we had a $30 drop, and it looks, if you look at the chart of gold today, looks like a parabolic drop, but since then, it's stabilized back up. It's now trading about $10 higher at 1460. So that's the speculative, the manic, the panic and greed market, in my opinion.
You know, Mickey, when we're checking the price on the futures market, you know, we can easily go to Kitco.com. What a listener who just follows that and wants to, get more, you know, more of an idea of what the physical market is doing? Is there, how can they do that? Is there any central place they can go or any statistic they can look at, or is it just kind of more anecdotal?
Well, it probably is somewhat more anecdotal, but you can look at U.S. mint sales for one thing, or the Perth Mint, the mint in Montreal, to get an idea of what's going on the physical side. But, you know, I read a lot, and so I go on the web, and certainly Kitco is a great source for us. And every day there's a couple of people write for Kitco that talk about the physical demand, the paper demand markets. And certainly what we're seeing going on in Asia right now, people are flocking to the gold shops trying to buy physical in China and Singapore and Hong Kong and India, of course. So this is the physical hoarding sort of safe haven buying that comes in when the price is low. So I can't give you an exact website, but anybody can do some due diligence, and I would certainly give my friends at Kitco a plug here and say that's a good place to start.
Okay, last question on this divergence between the physical and the paper markets. The gold that's sold in the physical market, by these shops and dealers, where is that coming from exactly? I mean, the producers who are selling, I mean, where does that go to? And eventually, do you know how it makes its way to, the small buyers?
Well, I know that most of the physical gold that's sold would be government-issued coins. So there are numerous governments worldwide. Started with the Krugerrand, the U.S. American Eagle, the Mexican gold, whatever it's called, the Mexican Aguila, and various other coins. The only one that I know of that is actually 100% gold is the Canadian maple leaf. All the other ones are alloyed with other metals. But so the mints supply those. Then you have the precious metal refiners such as Johnson Matthey and Credit Suisse, and they make bars, and you can buy bars all the way from an ounce bar up to 100 or a key 100 ounce or a kilo bar, so depending on what you want. So most of the products that come onto the market and are traded within the market come from the mints. In addition, there are placer miners, gold miners, that sell their placer gold. So that comes into the market, is certainly in North America. That comes on in the late fall and early winter, because most of the placer operations that I am aware of are in the Yukon and in Alaska. And I, in fact, buy my nuggets from a placer miner in Alaska.
Okay, Mickey, let's move on. And I want to talk about copper, because there's been some really important developments in that market since we last spoke. Couple of things I'm looking at. We'll get to the small news first. I'm just looking at some sentiment statistics where public opinion on copper right now is 26% bulls, which I'll say is the lowest, the least amount of bullish people since January 2009. So pretty extreme sentiment there. Of course, we've seen a huge move in copper the last couple of days, but I shouldn't forget the big news a couple of weeks ago of the landslide at the Bingham Canyon mine. Mickey, can you tell us the significance of that, and how does this impact your views on copper?
Well, there was a huge slide that was expected by Kennecott in Bingham Canyon, which is the largest man-made excavation on Earth, to my knowledge. It buried a portion of the bottom of the pit. It was bigger than they had thought it was and they had prepared for. Therefore, some copper production has come off for some period of time. I have yet to see an estimate of that period of time. That will take some significant amount of copper off the market this year. The Bingham Canyon mine is certainly within the top 10 copper mines in the world, but it is not much more than a top 10 mine. In other words, it must be toward the bottom of that top 10 ranking. Every year, the forecasters, the analysts that spend a lot of time on copper, will, at the beginning of the year or the end of the previous year, put a forecast on supply deficit for the coming year and a price prediction, a target price, average price for the year. They build into their models generally a 4% supply disruption. So the Bingham Canyon mine going offline, plus the Codelco strikes, and we always have some strikes and some accidents and some weather. So it looks to me with Bingham Canyon coming offline that the average build-in 4% supply disruption factored in is probably going to be higher this year. I remain a long-term copper bull. I'm on the fence right now in the short term. The idea that only 26% of the analysts in the business are bullish on copper or people that understand copper, to me, is a contrarian signal, and that's bullish for copper. So we saw a low this week, early in the week, of $3.08. It bounced to something about $3.25 yesterday. All commodities today, and this is Friday, April 26th, all commodities are off today, and including copper. The last price I saw on copper was $3.18.
Just, Mickey, hypothetically, on the price of copper, you know, what do you think would happen if we would see a move below three? I mean, I'm looking at a chart, 275, I see could be a level. And I just ask you because a lot of technical guys, they completely ignore the fundamentals and they look at a chart and then they say, oh, copper's completely broken down. It's finished. You know, the global economy's not growing anymore. But, I mean, there's really, you know, fundamentals really dictate the charts. And so I'm just asking you that question. What would happen to the supply demand, you know, if we saw a move below three, which would be about a 3-year low in the price?
Yeah, well, let's use 275, perhaps not three. Wouldn't surprise me if copper went below $3 or even to 275, which is where you think resistance is. And I'm not a technical guy. I'm purely a fundamental guy. But I certainly listen to people that have their hand in technical analysis, and I know that you do. If copper were to go down to 275, and that wouldn't really surprise me, I guess, because speculative markets, the pendulum swings too far on both sides, I think that production would come off. High-cost producers would cut back on production, which then would create a supply shortage, and I think the price will bounce right back up. I look at copper prices right now. That $3 looks like the base for me, to me. $2.75, I'm happy with that. Most financial models are using a long-term cost of copper at $2.75, price of copper at $2.75, and I dare say that could be the average all-in cost of producing copper in the world right now, somewhere around $2.75. So the copper market for the last 5 years has been in very tight supply demand balance. A couple of years we have minor surpluses, minor deficits, you know, but we're looking, these deficits are, we use 60,000 tons of copper a year in the world, and demand's growing year over year at 3 to 4%, and that's going to continue. And so these supply deficits, supply demand surplus deficits have been something on the order of a few hundred thousand tons, maybe a week's worth of production. Well, that's not very much copper. The world uses well over 20 million tons a year.
Right, so that kind of speaks to the long-term cycle that we're in, the long-term bullish fundamentals. You know, Mickey, just a thought on the bigger picture, I should say. Let me get a thought from you, because I know you follow supply and demand and copper, uranium, and all these markets. The financial crisis that we've had, of course, it's ongoing. But I mean, how has that impacted the long-term supply-demand dynamics of most commodities? And I ask that because, as we know, I mean, it takes a lot of money to get a mine up and going. Of course, you have to explore first and find the resource, outline it, develop it, et cetera, et cetera. It costs so much money, and I'm just wondering, given the credit crunch that we've had, I mean, isn't that going to be long-term really bullish for commodities? I mean, we're not seeing that many new mines opening up. Are we?
Well, your point's very well taken there, and I dare say we are still in a financial crisis. The banksters have been able to paper it over and kick the can down the road, if you will. And who knows how long they'll be able to do that? But what the financial crisis in 08 and 09 led to was a post-crash, another commodities boom, and energy costs being very high, and that's a major input in all build-outs of mines. Mines are very capital-intensive, and so the financing, and let me back up and say, and that led to exorbitant increases in capital expenditures for mines. We've seen CapExes skyrocket, and mines not, especially giant mines, not being built because the funding is simply not there. So the fact remains, we are not discovering, developing, and building out enough mines to take care of increased demand from Asia. So as long as Asia continues to grow, I remain very bullish on all commodities, even the soft commodities. And we've seen that today with a drop-off in soft commodity prices. We've had a bit of correction in all commodities today.
Okay, Mickey, before we close here, any final thoughts on anything that we didn't cover?
Well, leading on to that thought, the world is growing by 75 to 80 million people every year. So there are more hungry mouths to feed, and that requires more cropland and better yields. And so that demands soft commodities, which means that more people are going to demand mechanization of farming, which leads to more demand for the hard commodities. And we've got all these people wanting electricity. 25% of the world still can't turn on a light switch. They live in the dark. So all in all, it leads me to just be completely a long-term secular commodities bull.
All right, Mickey, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners how they can sign up for your free newsletter?
Just go to mercenarygeologist.com and click on the banner underneath my website and give us a name, and you can fake your name, but you have to give us a real email address. And you'll get something from me at least every Sunday. We also run 24/7 streaming internet radio. This interview will be posted as soon as you get it to me. And we are increasingly becoming active on Twitter, and I encourage everybody. We now have 28,000 Twitter followers, and we are active every day, and we're trying to be personal and engage people. So you can reach me at Twitter at Mercenary Geo.
Okay, Mickey, on that note, this being Friday, I wish you a great weekend, and thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, and all you got to do is call me, and I'm ready to go. So I love talking to you, Jordan, and I look forward to our next interview.